Any other thoughts here? Threshold, tipping point. Let's see.
Yeah, please. There's something, it's in a different direction, but it feels like it keeps coming up. And I think, especially in the realm of yoga, mm-hmm. In personal practice and especially in teaching, if I'm just hearing like, wow, it's so important to keep in mind that these postures shift things in people's bodies. Like that, that was sort of the design to like energy flows in a different way.
Right.
Which for a stabilized nervous system is oftentimes like feels kind of good or interesting and can stay with.
Yep.
And not always. Right? Yeah. Like, especially if there's not, there's like a more disorganized system. So it's something like I found myself more recently, like if I teach a backbends class, like I always name, you may feel more tender or more emotional or like you're a little crazy tonight. If you do, it's part of the yoga.
Yeah.
Like just know, like we did things, like you're, it's not you, like it, but like I feel...
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like this, like, it's so important to name that in spaces where people don't necessarily think they walk in because they want to feel good.
Yeah.
And yoga doesn't always make you feel good. It's totally. It makes you feel how you are if you do it. Like, if you actually listen, it brings up what's there.
Yeah.
And so just to, like, help, like, just make that a, like, more cultural, like, you may feel good, like Shavasana may make you feel good, may not.
Yeah, yeah.
So I totally. Just felt that, like, in this whole arc,
right.
feels really important.
Like, totally.
Especially totally. Those, and, like, for me, who I'm not a trained therapist, and have a lot of students who will come for the therapeutic impacts of yoga, which
Absolutely.
Is great.
Absolutely, and who will project upon you as if you are both a trained spiritual teacher and a trained therapist.
Yeah,
And that's a projection that yoga teachers get.
Yeah,
and so yeah, for sure. So that's a whole shadow. That this is really that becomes a conversation about scope of practice.
Yeah,
you know, like, are you actually qualified to diagnose someone's mental ailment or even like to help them with their meditation, if that's not your primary practice,
right.
you know. But people will totally be like, you know, hey, yoga teacher who I venerate and trust because you teach such an awesome class, I'm having this really hard time with my sweetheart in this exact way. What should I do? And, you know, this happens all over the place. I was in a teaching with this beautiful, wonderful monk at one point. One of the monastic elders in my tradition. So in my tradition, monk means he's been a celibate monastic for 30, 40 years, right? So, and someone came and said, you know, I'm having this really hard, difficult issue in my marriage. Here's what's happening. What do you think? And he said, I don't know. I don't do romantic relationship. I don't have any experience. Okay. And the person was kind of confused. They were like, but you're the enlightened one. And he was like, it's out of my scope of practice. You know?
Totally. Yes.
And so that totally happens with yoga teachers. And I think part of trainings like this is a way to even say, that will totally happen. Here's some basic skills that you can at least use.
Yeah.
You know? And if you want to increase your scope of practice, you just want to get more training. It's so funny that, like, people will come to yoga and say, like, I'm in yoga because I want to heal or because I want to feel good. But they don't actually want to admit that the practice will do things, will actually be effective. You know, like, oh, you do this, you will feel more. And people are like, I want to feel more. And then they feel more. And they were like, I don't know, I had this really intense class and it was just like, oh, man, like, I don't know, you know. Like, all sorts, you know. And I'm like, you know. But part of that is our fault in the yoga world, because we've turned this into a very casual kind of social scene, you know. So there's lots of layers there. Okay, I want to hit a couple other things while we're here. Based in this this model of threshold, I think what I want to open, there's a few different directions that we could touch into, but I want to do a little kind of investigation or process together, and yeah. So here's a model, and I'm gonna frame it in terms of this aspect of yoga and spiritual practice in general, spiritual practice from the South Asian tradition, so yoga and Buddhism primarily, Hindu and Buddhist yoga primarily, so we're talking about trauma, which means we're really talking about like healing the past in a certain way. And we're thinking about what would it mean for the past, whatever that is, to be led to completion within the complex system that is ourselves in such a way that it no longer troubles us, right? And that doesn't mean it's gone. It just means it's not actively tormenting. So like the terrible thing that happened to you, it will never not have happened, but your experience of it in the moment can be very different, right? So like it's really possible to have, you know, grieved it, settled it, set it down, and gone on with your life. Totally, you know, possible. And that might still mean that every time it comes up into the field, it's poignant or like, wow, achy, but not haunting you day and night. And that's what we're going for in healing trauma. If that's what we're talking about, then in a certain way, I'm going to come back into the yogic language and talk about identity a little bit. Because what we use the word identity, or like my sense of self, to point to the felt sense of something that is on a range between like, I have the sense of existing, like I know that I am in some way, it's kind of basic. It's the most basic. You may or may not be conscious of it, but here you go, you exist. Put that quotation marks, get there maybe. But there's the perception of it. I am, I exist, you do. And then I exist as distinct in some way. Like I know I'm me. I have a name, I have a narrative, this is my life story, this is my family, this is where I'm from, these are the things I do. And we talk about identity in the contemporary kind of social realm, particularly in terms of like group identities. You know, I'm straight or gay or bi or queer or something. I'm cisgendered or transgendered or variations on that spectrum now. I'm this race or that race or biracial or mixed race. There's all these ways that there are categories of identities that we can participate in and that will be projected on us whether we think we're participating in them or not. So it's part of our life. All of those things, from the individual, like, this is me, out to the social, like, I'm part of this group, all the way out to the kind of existence level, like, I exist, this exists, points to the activity in the psyche of assembling a sequence of experiences into a coherent narrative. And in a certain way, one of our definitions of sanity or of well-being is that my narrative of myself, which is both individual and family and communal, is coherent in some ways, you know. Like, and coherent in a sense means like contiguous. If we're talking about deep trauma, we're talking about stitching together discontinuous experiences. Coherent in a certain way is like, you know, I was born here, this is my family and what they did, these were the ways that, you know, we suffered, these are the ways we didn't suffer, I did this with my childhood, and then this, and then that, and this led to that, and here I am. And in a certain way, there's a linearity to it. Even if it was very mobile, the story has a kind of coherence in my psyche. And when that gets disrupted, that's often, you know, in places where there was strong trauma or subtle pervasive trauma, right? The things we think of as trauma are both like events, like the car wreck or the attack or the terrible thing that happened, finite. And then the subtle things like attachment rupture or developmental stuff that happens over time in a family. You know, I was never quite seen. That's not a singular event. That's a pervasive condition. That's getting closer to like the water. Those are harder to heal. Way easier to heal a car wreck than attachment rupture. And then bigger than that is the systemic. It's like, yeah, I've had a car wreck. Bleh. Yeah, I have attachment rupture. But actually, you know, I'm in a society where there's systemic racism and sexism. Ouch. That's this big level. The systemic things are so much bigger than the individual that the individual can't heal them. You can do a lot of work in yourself on any particular systemic issue, but the main thing you're going to accomplish in yourself is a kind of equanimity in relation to the big picture. Healing a big systemic ill is a systemic healing. So like, you know, perhaps it is only recently the case that there is a more or less general agreement in the post-industrial West that it's pretty much not good to overtly enslave people and torture them. And, you know, this is a relatively recent conversation, so we're not out of the woods of that one yet. But, like, we just had this confirmation hearing for this woman who ran a secret CIA prison back in the day, and she just got confirmed as the director of the CIA, Gina Haspel. And she was asked pointedly, because she ran one of these prisons where they did torture, and she was asked pointedly, will you now, like, literally and verbally, on the record, disavow the use of torture? And she squirmed and hemmed and hawed and would not say so. She would not do it, right? And it's like, we're still having the conversation about whether it's okay to torture people. But, so that's focusing on the red. That's terrible. Check it out. We're even having the conversation. And most people think she's wrong. So that's a social healing. Because 500 years ago, there was no conversation and there was no consensus, right? Think about something that at some point was completely the norm that is now pretty much unacceptable. Even if it still happens, it's something that... I like that song.
So sorry.
That's a big compliment coming from you.
I grew up in the 80s.
Apologize.
So think about like the big systemic things, and you know, folks who focus on social justice appropriately focus on the red, because that's your job. But think about if we're thinking about like, you know, there's a blue and a red to everything, and one of the things that's blue is the perception of progress, which means that even if things suck, and you can perceive that they're better than they were before, then shifting your attention to that can shift the nervous system, can shift the system, which doesn't mean you're ignoring what's wrong. It actually just means that the system gets to deactivate in order to have more choices and more well-being available to it. So this is delicate with something like the big systemic ills. I've been calling these the great demons lately. Because it's so clearly the case that unlike an individual healing from trauma, you know, let's say like I'm trying to heal from attachment rupture, right? So I'm going to choose something that's big and it's like the water I'm swimming in. It's not just a car wreck. And it is the case that even if I focus on what's positive, like I have good friends right now and I know how to make friends and I feel loved sometimes, you know, I'm starting to learn how to trust people, like all that stuff. I could focus on that stuff. It is still going to be the case that that rupture happened and I'm wounded by it forever. Like, that's just true. I might never become a fully, like, welcomed into the human tribe, feeling like I'm welcomed into the human tribe kind of being. It might take a very long time for that to happen. The difference between the individual and the systemic is that I can come to equanimity with that as an individual. And in a certain way, I can say, okay, that is how it is. And I'm going to make the best of it and keep healing. And I can come to a lot of self-acceptance. Partly because I'm recognizing that that harm happened and cannot be undone. And that progress in the present is then totally possible, but is just slow, right? You don't radically suddenly shift your personality in that way. I'm going to propose that this is actually true on the systemic level as well, but it's harder to do because on the systemic level, it's so much bigger and so much more complicated that it's harder to admit that the painful past happened and can't be fixed. And it's harder to accept how little we can do in the present. It really feels like if we try harder and do more, we can do more. And that's true. But the result of that is that it still is very, very easy to only focus on the problem, to only focus on the red. And so, and I want to say this very delicately because it's actually just true that we need to focus on it. And so it becomes this very challenging dance. The proposition here basically is that that every level of the system works the same way. And so the systemic works the same way, but it only works the same way if we understand the entire system as an individual. In other words, let's take the nation state right now. Let's say that our nation right now is has come out of a certain amount of freeze or denial around, you know, I'll use sexual harassment as the example. A few things happened recently such that a whole bunch of people were willing to express the sympathetic nervous system being angry rather than expressing freeze, shutting down, avoiding, mm-hmm. Nothing's going to happen anyway. So that flip, and that was a tipping point. That's a threshold, right? And nowadays, with the speed of communication, which is brilliant right now, nowadays a tipping point really is like, you know, somebody tweeted something with a hashtag that landed, and then it was retweeted a million times in 24 hours. That's a tipping point, right? Why did that happen, right? And that's a complex system. Things get tweeted all the time. Gazillions of them all the time. Something hits and it gets retweeted and it retweeted and the mathematics of this is the exponential curve, right? It's not a linear arc. Something hits and that's the threshold curve is an exponential curve, right? It goes ja 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 whoosh, boom. So our culture hit threshold on sexual harassment by powerful men, and suddenly this thing exploded where all this stuff came out of freeze. It deactivated, actually, from freeze. Like, this is too difficult to deal with. And it came into the realm of, we can deal with this, right? And suddenly everything is much more painful, right? It's chaotic, actually. It's shifted into like, that's called a chaotic phase shift in complexity things. Boom. And suddenly there's all this stuff happening. And like, boom, you know, that one, that one, that one. Boom. And, you know, for a while, my Facebook feed was people going, WTF, Garrison Keillor? Like, what? And then, like, you know, like, oh, no, Al Franken. We needed his vote. Like, you know, whatever it was. It's like, And so like boom, 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 it hits threshold. And what we are, what we're wanting is not that every individual gets named and comes to justice. We do want justice. And for anyone harmed, we want justice. But what's hopeful actually is that if the entire system shifts state, like it hits boiling, then the possibility actually is that the entire system could deactivate. And that would mean that lots of these individual cases come to resolution, but that's not actually the point. The point is that there would be a kind of moral shift in the entire culture that makes a certain amount of activity simply unthinkable. Not something that we have to resist by force of will, but actually simply unthinkable. You know, in the way that once upon a time torture was no big deal, slavery was no big deal, and suddenly it's unthinkable. And we're not yet there with those two. We're not yet there with sexual harassment. But we are there with some other things, you know. And so the perspective, I think, on the systemic, I suspect that one of the most helpful perspectives is really just a certain amount of long view. And some approach that says, like, I have a lot of feeling about this right now. What is actually the most helpful intervention I can do to the system in this moment? And if we think about the threshold model, sometimes the helpful intervention is going to be to heat things up. We talked a little bit about the protests and, you know, the Antifa thing. Sometimes the right thing to do is to make it worse, is to shine a big bright light on it first, to shout loudly, to break some windows, to somehow help the system hit threshold. And the system really doesn't want to hit threshold in many cases, you know? So it's like, there's going to be denial, there's going to be resistance. And there's a couple possibilities. Let's keep going with Me Too as an example. One possibility is that our culture hits threshold with it. And the change is that now men in power everywhere are self-conscious of how they treat others and are aware of their own blindness and drives in such a way that a renewed level of respect, which turns into morality, builds, and probably it takes, I'm going to say, two generations from a tipping point for that thing to change, because those guys already taught their sons to be a certain way. But a few generations and something is just like toast, right? There's all these studies that say among like millennial like kids, even in the most fierce evangelical far-right realms of the United States, are way more tolerant of, let's say, gay marriage than their parents. Tipping point, right? We just hit the tipping point on legal cannabis. The fight is over, right? Now we're on the downslope where there's going to be some resistors, but it's over, right? At least for now. And it can always swing back. Hopefully I read some articles like, oh, we reached the tipping point on the gay marriage fight. It's just, we got it. It doesn't mean we got it everywhere, but it's happening. And there's little setbacks, but it's happening. So then like a couple generations, and you know you've reached full deactivation when the kids are like, meh. It's not a thing.
Yeah.
You know? I am so far from caring about the conflict between Catholics and Protestants. Like, I don't even know which of my friends are Protestant and Catholic. My parents were absolutely aware of that distinction. And my grandparents structured their social world based on that distinction, you know, et cetera. I don't know if mine specifically did, but that's the generational shift. So like, what if that's true with something like, you know, sexual harassment, right? What if our generation is the chaos generation, and then my son's children, if he has them, they just don't do that? Like, that would be amazing. You know, what a blessing if they don't do that. But that's the rate of the systemic nervous system changing. Right. So that's kind of the model. So I want to do a little investigation then for us individually to flesh something out. This thing that I'm offering you is not strictly organic intelligence. It's based in organic intelligence, and it's really me blending the organic intelligence nervous system work. It's a bundle of things, so take one bundle.
Staple.
One staple bundle.
Yeah.
So, to kind of name my lineages, one of the things that I'm doing here essentially is I'm talking to you from three basic modalities. One is the nervous system trauma work. My main lineage in that is organic intelligence, which is from somatic experiencing and parvagal theory. The other primary lineage, of course, is the South Asian contemplative traditions, Buddhism and Hindu yogas. And the third is contemporary critical theory and social justice work. And so each of those brings a particular flavor. So this thing I'm going to offer you now is a little reflection to do together that brings our work a little more toward the systemic, and it also speaks a little bit to the identity layers that we get from the Indian contemplative traditions. So, two models here. The first model is one way that I'm talking lately about the teaching of karma. And I started this yesterday with us. Understanding that, you know, if trauma is things happened in the past, their effects continued through time, and I'm still feeling them now as a symptom. That's basically the teaching of karma. Actions have effects. And so then purification is first to move from harmful action to beneficial action, and then eventually to move to the end of action altogether. So here's a model that takes that teaching into a particular realm of contemporary discourse. And this is what I call the trauma privilege spectrum. We use the word trauma to say bad things happened in the past that had effects into the present. But what about positive things that happened, or like helpful things that happened in the past? That's great. In the Buddhist tradition, we would just call that good karma. But a lot of those things we could now recognize as not like sort of ethically neutral good things, but actually the result of privilege. In other words, I felt safe growing up. That's not the norm. Therefore, it's a privilege. Privilege emerges as a term in contemporary social justice work as a way to recognize that there are benefits that some people have in this life that they did not earn, but that they hold based on their membership in certain identities that have power. So I have male privilege. I have some amount of white privilege. I'm mixed race, half Puerto Rican, half Episcopalian, I like to say. I'm close enough to white that I got the benefits of whiteness more or less. My wife disagrees with that one a little bit. She says I should be more conscious of my brown side and the oppression it faced. But I feel like nobody ever told me in any way that I sensed. So I feel like I got that privilege. So privilege I'm now going to define as the other end of that spectrum karmically. So trauma, the condition of trauma is that there was danger and harm in the past. Danger is sort of the condition and harm is the actions. I was in dangerous settings, and I was harmed, and/or. So then the other end of that spectrum is, in the past, I was in safe settings, and I was helped. And it's a privilege simply because, you know, that's the result of conditions. And it's not the norm, right? And the thing about privilege that's important as healing, and here's the punchline already, is that both of them need to be healed. Healing from trauma means coming to completion on self-protective responses so that you once again can feel safe. Healing from privilege means coming out of denial and thinking that what you got was the norm or what you deserved or anything like that, and coming out into recognizing that it was conditions. And so the condition of trauma is danger and harm in the past. The condition of privilege is safety and help in the past. And the way I experience that in the present is the symptoms of that past, right? I was raised safe. I generally feel safe. I was raised in a culture where, being a man, I wasn't threatened very much, so I generally feel unthreatened. And then, you know, calling it male privilege is not an attack on me. It's actually just an invitation for me to come out of denial and be like, yeah, that's a privilege, right? I'm so grateful. But what it really means is, oh my God, I'm crushed to realize that that's not everybody's experience. And that's hopefully the result of a conversation on privilege, is a certain amount of heartbreak, coming out of delusion. So the symptom of trauma is that in the present, I feel pain and distress, regardless of what's happening. The symptom of privilege is that in the present, I feel comfort and ease. One of the challenges with something like deep internal practice is that comfort and ease is actually one of the prerequisites we want for deep internal practice. And what this is going to weirdly mean is that people with some amount of privilege actually often go further in meditation because their nervous systems can do it. They feel safe enough to go inward. That means that a prerequisite for meditation that's going to be more broadly possible in a culture is actually healing cultures that are unsafe. You have to actually be able to feel safe before you can go deeply inward. So it's a privilege to be able to do deep inner work. You know, and I've totally talked to people who are like, that sounds great, but you know, like, I can't do that. And it's not just like, oh, my mind doesn't concentrate in that way. It's actually even deeper than that. It's like, I can't take a week off work to go sit in the hills. It's a million things, right? I teach and I assist an organization that does mindfulness retreats for teenagers called IBME. They're super awesome. Check them out if you like working with youth. Meditation retreats for kids 14 to 19, I think, is the range, somewhere in there. What's that? IBME. It stands for Inward Bound,
okay.
Mindfulness Education. And they partner with Outward Bound, so they do wilderness-based meditation work also. Super awesome. But IBME, they're super cool. And one year they wanted to bring in a more diverse student cohort and offer these incredible kind of experiences that were happening to kids from more disadvantaged backgrounds. And they did beautifully with it. Like, it was great. But one of the things they realized that they hadn't noticed because it was still a fairly white organization and a fairly middle-class organization, they got a bunch of kids who were super excited to go, super into the work, you know, great folks. And they got them out to this, like, beautiful retreat center, you know, in the Sonoma Mountains, in the wilderness. And, you know, but nice cabins, nice food, blah, blah, blah. And the privileged kids, you know, they're just like, woohoo! We're like, we're in this awesome place. And there were some kids who had the presence of mind to say, I've never been out of the city before, and I don't like it. And the organizers were like, what? This is the woods. This is great. This is awesome. And the kids were like, I don't like it out here. And they were like, oh, we didn't know. Right? It's actually a privilege to be able to enjoy that. Like, you have to be exposed to it. And they were like, oops, you know, sorry, I'm so sorry. Like, they missed it. And, you know, and to their credit, they just learned from that and, you know, did it differently. But the shadow of privilege is delusion and entitlement. Basically, the shadow is like denial. You don't know the water you're swimming in. And so part of the answer to, like, what is water is, like, you need somebody else to tell you the things that you can't see for yourself. And this is true in the internal trauma healing as much as it, you know, in the systemic. And the best practice when you're told something that you didn't notice before is to try to be open to it. And this is the main thing that folks run into, you know, is like, there's all these terms like, you know, white fragility. It's like, what is white fragility? That means like white people who can't deal with being told that they have white privilege and get all messed up like, but I have good intentions, or they break down and like can't hold their center. And it's like, it's a term because that response is so common. And it's common because when you shine a light on the shadow, it's uncomfortable. And it's like, oh, I have been taught, here's an example, like I've been taught that my success in the world was because I worked hard and I really believed in myself. And you know, I had to work really hard to get where I am in this life. And then someone comes up and says, your success is because the entire system is built to uplift you. And yes, you worked hard, but the fact that you were able to work hard and do it already meant you had this massive lead that you were blind to. But the fact that you were being told that it wasn't all you undercuts your ego stability. Like, wait, I had to work really hard to get where I am. You know, and it's like, you got booster rockets strapped onto your thighs when you were two, and you've never noticed them because they've always been there. And you think you had to learn to run, you know. So then the practice is like, oh, I have to actually be able to receive that and let it hit me. And be like, oh, that's true, you know. So each of these has a shadow. The shadow of privilege is delusion, entitlement, denial. The shadow of trauma, I mean, continuing calling it a shadow because it's the unseen. But the unseen with trauma is very often strength and resourcefulness, being able to do a lot with less. And one that I didn't put on here, it's sort of a different category, but it's true. Very often, but not always, one of the strengths from certain kinds of trauma is communal connection. It's often recognized that, like, rich folks tend to isolate where poor folks tend to come together. And so, like, one of the strengths in poor communities might be, you know, a sense of like communal belonging. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody's got everybody's back. You're suffering. Somebody's going to take care of you. Nobody has very much, but we figured it out together. Right? That's a like poverty to lower middle class kind of attitude. The rich attitude is like, when I have a challenge, I have the resources to deal with it, or I pay somebody to deal with it. But I don't have to make contact with others. And the more privilege I have, the less contact I need to have with others, essentially. So then privilege tends toward isolation. And that has so many layers in it, you know. So this is just a hint. Completion, or healing in relation to trauma, I'm calling completion and integration. So those forces that were trying to manifest to protect you, they got to complete, and those experiences get integrated into a healthy ego structure. Healing in relation to privilege is recognition, coming out of denial, and then the transformation of the energy that I have based in privilege into service. Basically like, oh, I can see how much I've been given. I want to give back. I want to help the system. So then I think of these as a spectrum, and those are the poles. And this is a description of karma. Basically, beneficial and harmful stuff happened in your past. You're still feeling their results. What would it mean to come to completion in both of those aspects, or all of those aspects? And this is a kind of liberation in relation to both. I'm not grasping onto the pleasurable. I'm not resisting the painful. It comes right back to the approach-avoid system that we started with in the very beginning of the class history. So that's the first level here. Any questions on that, or anything that sort of resonates in you? I know I'm kind of pinging some topics that are deep and might sort of make you a little antsy because there's so much there. But anything that you want to bring in or mention here?